History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've discovered is they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest enough time to listen patiently as memories, sometimes buried for decades, start to take on new meaning in the here and now. Our aim, of course, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The World War II veteran we have the privilege of getting to know today has been on quite a journey over the last 96 years. How many nonagenarians do you know who drive themselves 15 miles each way to work every weekday? What that work happens to be is pretty fascinating, too, and we'll get to all of that eventually with Herbert Ford of Exeter, California, a veteran of the Merchant Marine, the Army Air Corps, and ultimately the U.S. Air Force, who also happens to be a prolific author still working on multiple manuscripts. A good portion of his professional life orbits around a tiny island in the Pacific with some pretty noteworthy history. But Mr. Ford's history starts out in the Lone Star State. I know you were an only child, but what do you remember about those early years?
Well, I think growing up in Texas, you're always talking about football. And the big thing in Texas in those days for a young fellow growing up was he's going to make his way to the University of Texas Longhorns or to Texas A&M, the Aggies, and those were big things. We had lots of contact with Spanish-speaking people there in South Texas because we were right on the border, and it was a joy to meet with them. We always felt that Spanish-speaking people in that part of America were great people.
How big was your hometown?
The population of San Benito, where I was born, was about 3,000. And then I grew up in the nearby town of Harlingen, Texas, and that would have been about 12,000 people, not large cities.
Do you remember as a young boy having some ambitions, some hopes, some dreams, some thoughts, hey, someday this is what I'm going to do with my life?
I always wanted to be in the petroleum industry because in that part of Texas, a lot of oil wells were drilled, and I saw the big, splendid cars that the oil executives would travel around in. And I decided that I wanted to own some oil wells and live high on the world. But that just didn't occur.
And most of us around today didn't live through the Great Depression, but you were a boy during those years. Did your family feel the effects of that at all?
Well, yes, they did. Of course, I was born in 1927. We lived very, very simply. It was a scratch type of life. My mother, I grew up in a single family home, or a single person home, just my mother. And she had to work terribly hard hours to make enough money to live on. She would start in the morning at about 4 o'clock, making 80 pies for a cafeteria and delicatessen in the town of Harlingen. She, of course, paid for my education. She wanted me to be in a Christian school. So that was a part of the difficulty of growing up in those days. Money was very, very scarce. People simply had to do without.
I know a good portion of your 96 years have been spent working on this topic of Pitcairn Island, and we're going to talk more about that. But when did that idea, that fascinating legend, if you will, first kind of captivate your mind?
Yes, well, the mutiny on the Bounty, a famous British naval incident, brought Pitcairn into national light and international light, because the mutineering sailors went to Pitcairn Island to hide away from the British that were looking for them. But I was about 7 years old when I first heard the names of Pitcairn in mission stories that would be told in the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Harlingen, Texas. The story fascinated me, and I just could never get it out of my mind.
And we're going to get some real evidence of that here in a little while. I don't want to gloss over anything, but there seems to be everyone I've encountered that was alive then has some kind of memory about December 7th, 1941, and the attack on Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you found out about that or where you were?
Yes, I remember quite specifically. I was in my family home. The address was 1018 West Grant Street in Harlingen, Texas. And it was in the early afternoon. And for some reason, the family radio was on. And I listened in wonderment, because I was still a young person, to the idea that airplanes had dropped bombs on Hawaii. At that time, Hawaii just didn't seem to be anywhere in the world as far as I was concerned. But I could tell from the look on my mother's face and a couple of other people that were in the room that this was a very serious matter. And that was the afternoon of December 7, 1941.
And did you notice things changing in Harlingen after that?
Well, the change came in that young men started going away from town. Purchases were different in that people had to have stamps from a little book to buy sugar and buy other things. And of course, metal was almost impossible to get, sheet metal or anything like that, because everything began to go toward the war effort. So things changed very much. A lot of people started using bicycles to conserve gas and things like that. So it did change very much there in Harlingen.
And when did it start to become real to you that you might end up being a part of this global conflict?
Well, for a long time, it didn't seem to get to me. But in the early part of 1945, I knew I was going to be drafted into the service, even though the war had continued and was seeming to be won. But I saw a poster one day, and it said that Uncle Sam needed you, and then applied to me. And so I decided that I would join the United States Merchant Marine, or the maritime service of the country. Went to San Francisco and signed up, and was assigned to what's called a T2 tanker, which is a large tanker ship, carried 141,000 barrels of fuel oil for other ships. And we sailed from San Pedro, California into the Pacific Ocean, went down to Ulithi in the Caroline Islands of the Pacific, had no orders to discharge any of our cargo there, and were reassigned to the Philippines. We were there, and then reassigned from there to go up to Tokyo, Japan, with the invasion fleet that went up in 1945. And we discharged our cargo mostly on a real huge white hospital ship with the Red Cross painted on the side, and the remainder of our fuel was discharged onto a Navy tanker called the Tule Canyon. Then we turned around and headed back for the United States, arrived back in San Pedro November 24 of 1945, and then I got a notice from my draft board that if I was not back on my ship on December 25, that I would be immediately drafted. I didn't like the idea of being drafted as a ground pounder and into the Army, and so I went to Brownsville, Texas, and signed up with the United States Army Air Corps, and from there was assigned basic training up on the Red River in North Texas. The moment I was done with my basic training. I was assigned to the Pentagon building in Washington, D.C., and served almost the entirety of my three-year hitch in the Air Force at that time. During that period of time, the name was changed from the United States Army Air Corps to the United States Air Force. So I got out of the service on December 31, 1948, and began to be a student at a college in Northern California.
And I have a few follow-up questions there, because I know some of this may not seem like a big deal to you, especially all these years later, but as I try to put myself in your shoes, you're a 17-year-old in the Pacific on a ship that's full of fuel. You have to be thinking there's submarines out there, something could go wrong. What were your realistic expectations at the time?
Well, I guess I'm too naive. I wasn't very worried about it, although we, of course, had a big gun on the bow of our ship, a 4-inch 5 gun, and a Navy gun crew that was assigned to handle that gun. But we had to fill in for the Navy crew in the case they were taken out during an action. So we were always concerned about this matter, but to me, it was that there was work to be done every day and kept your mind busy. There were nice things that happened, of course. For the first time in my life, I saw a moon bow. There's the rainbow. But at night and over the oceans, at rare times, there is a bow that's constructed from the rays of the moon that are just like a rainbow in the daytime. A lot of nice memories from that service, but of course the threat was always there.
Well, yeah, and you also said something there that your ship was part of this invasion fleet. So the invasion of Japan was planned and would have happened without the atomic bombs being dropped. How did you feel about that idea? Did you really think you were going to make it back to America, or did you have your doubts?
What I had was my aspiration, and that was to aspire to get back to America. Because, frankly, my service on the ship wasn't as fantastic as I thought it should have been, you know. But it was a feeling that of immensity that just really hits you when you go into your parking place in Tokyo Bay with this invasion fleet, and I say your parking place in the water, of course, and you see row after row after row of aircraft carriers and destroyers and submarines and all kinds of military, naval ships and things like that. That force would have rendered anybody impotent, I think. It was just a huge thing, and we, of course, were not able to get to the Missouri where the actual service of surrender went on, but we, of course, had radio communication with them and had some crude type of scene that we could see what was going on.
So September 2nd, 1945, when they're on the Missouri signing the surrender, you were actually in Tokyo Bay.
That's correct. Yes, we were. We were able to get off the ship and go into town, into Yokohama, really. It was a sight you just wouldn't believe. There was hardly a building standing anywhere. It was just a flat surface of destroyed places. There were a few. One of my friends in the media, Carl Maidens, who was one of Life magazine's early photographers, was also there. He went to a place in Yokohama about the same time I was there that made lenses for cameras. And he used these Japanese lenses in his cameras before the war. And he was interned for a while and then got out and accompanied MacArthur up to Tokyo. But anyhow, Carl went and found the people who were making these lenses and told them what great lenses they made. They said to him, "Oh, Mr. Maidens, that's so wonderful, but why don't our lenses sell to the world? We want to sell to the world." He said, that's because you have Japanese markings on your lenses and you need lenses that people can understand. Oh, they said, would you make some markings for us? And they did that, he said, and ever after, if especially finely ground lens came through the line in that company, they would set it aside and send it to Carl Mydans, and it became a Mydans lens for them.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 96-year-old Herbert Ford of Exeter, California. More memories, not just from World War II, but from the Korean War era as well. One of his memories from his years in the Pentagon involves a legendary general and a situation Mr. Ford feared might get him court-martialed. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.